1 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 12 through 27. For just as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of the body, though many, are one body, so it is with Christ. For in one spirit we were all baptized into one body, Jews or Greeks, slaves or free, and all were made to drink of one spirit. For the body does not consist of one member, but of many. If the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I do not belong to the body, that would not make it any less part of the body. And if the ear should say, because I am not an eye, I do not belong to the body, that would not make it any less part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would be the sense of hearing? If the whole body were an ear, where would be the sense of smell? But as it is, God arranged the members in the body, each one of them as he chose. If all were a single member, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, yet one body. The eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you, nor again the head to the feet, I have no need of you. On the contrary, the parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. And on those parts of the body that we think less honorable, we bestow the greater honor. And our unpresentable parts are treated with greater modesty, which our more presentable parts do not require. But God has so composed the body, giving greater honor to the part that lacked it, that there may be no division in the body, but that the members may have the same care for one another. If one member suffers, all suffer together. If one member is honored, all rejoice together. Now you are the body of Christ and individually members of it. This is the word of the Lord. Please be seated.
I had a friend in California. Oh, it was a while ago now. I'm going to say 15 years ago. And he came up to me and he said, and we were actually talking about some of the decisions that he had made in the past years, the past few years. And they were divisive decisions. They were bad. He said, you know, when my daughter got married 5 years ago, she played that song to me. She played this song, Did You Ever Know That You're My Hero? Now, you know, just by telling the story, it's about 15 years old. But when he was telling that story, he got really sad because he said, I don't think she would play that song today. That actually what had happened in his relationship with his daughter was that as a result of some of the decisions he had made, there was a division, and it was devastating. I believe we can all relate. We have all experienced divisions. I would even say we can say they're universal and often devastating. And sometimes we're just a spectator to these divisions. That is, we just kind of see them happening in front of us and we don't have much to do with it or not much means to resolve anything. But sometimes what we've found, no doubt, is we can be the instigators of division. And these divisions are often very painful. Whether it's divorce or breakdowns between siblings to the point where they don't speak anymore, or parent and child no longer communicating, just distancing themselves. These divisions hurt. Hurt bad enough to make us ask the question, is there anything I can do to avoid them? Is there any way that I can avoid being an instigator of division? 1 Corinthians is a letter written by the Apostle Paul to the church in Corinth, and he's writing in response to a church that is divided, it seems like, over just about everything. They are divided over who they are going to follow, that is one saying I'm a follower of Peter, one saying I'm a follower of Paul, one of Apollos. They're divided by lawsuits. They're divided over what they eat. They're divided over what they wear. There's a division between rich and poor. They're divided, we read here in chapter 12, even over giftedness. Is there an answer to this? Does Paul lay out any hope for us to avoid division? And if so, what is it? I want to say Paul does give us an answer. That in 1 Corinthians, he tells us what not to do, and he tells us what to do. And he even goes on to tell us what will happen if we don't do the things we shouldn't do and we do the things we're being called to do. He tells us what will happen and where God will take us. Travis has been talking in the last few weeks. We've been experiencing as a congregation this reality that the church is the vehicle, the means that God carries out his movements. We're not just a vehicle that's going nowhere. There's actually a particular destination that God is taking us to. That Paul is answering the question of, can we avoid being instigators of division? He lays it out for us. But before we get into it, I think it's important for all of us to admit that we're desperate for God's intervention in this matter. That he would make us who we were created to be, a church united, not divided, and members of the body, members of the church, who bring about unity, not division, who are always seeking peace and avoiding being instigators of division. I'd like to point out also that Paul is writing to the church. So Paul is talking about unity in the church. Is unity in the church possible? And he lands on yes. Unity in the church is actually, you are united. This is who you are. But he is not talking about division outside of the church. We're hearing a lot in the news today. It's actually nothing new. There has been division outside the church for all time. And moving forward, it will exist to the day Christ returns. When I'm asked, can we talk more about division outside the church? I want to say, our answer is unity within the church. And then we move out into a world that's divided, that's riddled with anger and fear and division. And we offer to them Jesus Christ and his united body, his church, that they might find hope and healing, peace and unity. So for the rest of this service, I want to talk about Paul's answer to the question of, can division be avoided in the church? And where I'm convinced Paul starts in chapter 12 is with a statement something like this. God arranges the members in the body as he chooses. It's interesting, right? When we ask the question, how do I avoid division? How do I avoid being an instigator of division? I don't want that pain, that agony, right? The death that I taste when I bring it about. What do I do? What do you want me to do? Paul never starts with what to do. Paul always starts with this foundation of truth. Who we are, who God is and who we are in Him, and how is this world working? How does the church work? What is the foundational truth? Paul starts with truth. And his truth, before we do anything, is that God arranges the members in the body as He chooses. You see it in verse 18 of chapter 12. We see this picture of God's doing the arrangement. He's the arranger. Okay, so what do we see about, maybe what can we learn about a couple of the characteristics of this arrangement? Well, for one, we read in verse 1 of chapter 12, we started in verse 12, but if we reach back a little bit, in verse 1 and in verse 7, we read that all the members are gifted. All the members of the body, all believers, every member of the church is gifted, that we have all received the manifestation of the Spirit. God has poured out His Spirit into our hearts because He loves us. And He has gifted us for the common good. This is actually not where my mind was going when I think of the first time I decided as an adult to follow Jesus. I can remember during that prayer, what I was embracing was that I am forgiven, that I'm guiltless. But the idea of gifted for the common good, that wasn't in my head. God is guiding me? Absolutely. I'm desperate for His guidance? Absolutely. I'd seen the train wreck without Him. But it's more than just guidance and forgiveness that He's gifted each one of us, we read in 1 Corinthians 12. Well, what's another characteristic of this arrangement of God's? Well, the members are gifted and the body is one. In the first two verses we read today, verses 12 and 13, the word one comes up five times. It's used five times. This chapter is just hammering home this point. Paul's writing to a church that's experiencing all sorts of division, and he's saying you have to understand this. The body is one. All right. So God arranges the members in the body as He chooses. The members are gifted for the common good, and the body is one. Then why do we experience so much division? Why do we still feel breakdowns in our family and amongst our friends and even with strangers? Where is this coming from? I want to say, divisions exist when we listen primarily to people. That this is the root of the problem. That, and when I say we listen to people, I don't mean just other people. I mean ourselves included. That we're listening to people and we're listening to the voices in our own heads. And we're listening primarily to people. And as a result, we're experiencing division. The division exists when we listen primarily to people. Okay, so what does it sound like? What does it sound like when we're listening primarily to people? We're given at least two examples in 1 Corinthians 12. The first example, first phrase that might come to mind when we're thinking, what do we hear when we're listening primarily to people? What we hear is this message that I am not. It's in verse 14, right? This idea of I'm just a foot, I'm not a hand. That somehow I'm not worthy. Who's saying this? This is not coming from God. This is a message that we're giving to ourselves and hearing from others. If we're hearing I am not, it's not from God. we're listening primarily to people. And when we get this message of I am not, it's sometimes associated with what we can't do, right? Something that we cannot do. I don't know, we're not gifted enough or talented enough, or we don't have the right social status or the right education. And so we think, because I'm lacking these things, I am not. But normally, at least when I've experienced it in my own life and the majority of people I talk to who are hearing and believing, I am not. It's not because of what they can't do. It's because of what we have done. That we begin to believe that because of certain flaws in our character, certain things we've done in the past, that they're just unforgivable, too shameful. There's no way, because of what I've done, to get out from underneath these voices, my own included, that are telling me, I am not. I want to tell you, those voices are people's voices. And it's not true. What's interesting is our common, natural, human response to this very divisive thought that I am not. Like, that's really what's happening, right? When we buy into I am not, we're saying, I'm not what? I can't be part of the body. We've divided ourselves off based on some inability or sin that we think we've done. But then often our response to this message of I am not is equally divisive. We'll hop over on the other side of this depression with pride. We'll say something close to verse 21, right? Well, we say, I am. And those mean people who keep telling me I'm not, they're not. And I don't need them. And it's even understandable, right? If we meet somebody who's being crushed by criticism, someone we care about, it's kind of easy, isn't it, to say, don't listen to those jerks. It's like you just start feeding this divisive thought with another one that feeds pride, and we want to say, I don't need that person. I'm just fine by myself. That both of these phrases, I am not, or I am and I don't need, they're both divisive. And they keep us in this cycle, this divisive cycle. I was reading a book recently called The Freedom of Self-Forgetfulness. And the author presented evidence that if we're doing this, then we're stuck in this cycle of I am not, or I am and I don't need you. And the evidence was this. If criticism crushes you, devastates your world, keeps you up at night, then you're caught up in believing what people say. Oh, can anyone relate to just being crushed by criticism? Is it possible it's because we are listening primarily to people? I had a woman come up to me one time and she said, I really like your sermons. I appreciate them. She said, my friend hates your voice. But I don't mind it. So funny. I said, thank you. Thank you. That's encouraging. Now, She's actually a friend, and if you know her, it's not too surprising. It was just funny. But we can do that, right? Like, we're going to catch criticism. And if it devastates us or enrages us, brings about bitterness and anger, then we're caught up in it. Right? We're caught up in this divisive cycle. Division exists when we listen primarily to people. Okay. So what do we do? What do we do instead? Is there a chance for unity? We've already said, Paul said there is. Yes, this is what we don't do. We do not get caught up listening primarily to people. What do we do? Well, unity exists when we listen primarily to God. And what's God saying? God's saying, we're all gifted and we are all one. That this giftedness that we all possess is for the common good, and that we're interdependent on each other. But I think before we ever trust God's plan for unity within the church, we have to first trust God himself. Last week, there were just an abundance of testimonies connected with those baptisms that I found to be powerful, moving. There was one in particular that really stood out to me, and it was in second service, so maybe some of you saw it, but there was a ninth grade girl named Megan Freeman who was sharing why she wanted to be baptized. And she talked about wanting to be baptized because realizing just how much God had done for her, what had got her to this point, how she had been an orphan until the age of 4 in Hong Kong, and her family had adopted her. And not only had her parents created a family for her and told her about Jesus, but also that she had found family right here at the chapel. And then Luke Kincaid, who was interviewing her, asked, "Do you have a favorite verse?" And she said, "Yes, I do." She said, Psalm 18:19. "He brought me into a spacious place. He rescued me because he delights in me. I thought I was going to lose it." I felt my wife shaking a little bit next to me. I was pretty sure she was losing it. Then I looked up at the choir and I thought, how on earth are they going to sing? They're all losing it. People are just trying to wipe mascara off their face. I think what was so powerful about that testimony was at least a couple things. One was how good our God is. That he has communicated so clearly to this young lady that he delights in her. But what was also so moving was that through Megan, this ninth grade girl, what I heard loud and clear through the Holy Spirit in her was that God delights in me. And sometimes that's a lot harder to believe, isn't it? Sure, he can delight in that beautiful ninth grade girl, but that he delights in me. It was a picture of God's interdependent body working. That everyone from the outside would say, for sure, parents invest in this young lady, and a church full of adult Sunday school teachers or older small group leaders investing in her, that makes sense. But we see this interdependent body. We see God's plan playing out as all of these young believers minister to some who have been following the Lord for 50 years. That this is how God does it. This is his plan. Unity exists when we listen primarily to God. I am sure that girl heard plenty of messages that she is not, Maybe she was tempted to also say, oh, I am and they are not. It wouldn't have helped. It wouldn't have solved any of the division. What she heard from the Lord that saved her, rescued her, made her, was that he delights in her. And he is moving her to serve and be served in God's body. This interdependent body where every member is gifted and yet we are all one and we are gifted for the common good. We're going to actually get out a little bit early here from the service. But you're not off the hook. You don't get to catch lunch early. We're letting you out a little bit early so that you can move out into the foyer and experience a ministry fair that's going on out there. And it's just an invitation to consider two things. How might God want to use me to serve others? And secondly, how might God want to use others to serve me? That as you walk through these 19 different tables out there, you might think, I would love to serve here. You might also walk by some of those tables and see some of those ministries out there and think, I could use that ministry. Maybe for some of you, it's finding out more about Celebrate Recovery or signing up to meet with a Stephen minister, someone to talk with, or I don't know. What I do know is that God delights in you. And his design is an interdependent body. And that we have to seriously consider, where is he calling me to serve? And where do I need to receive service? This is what to do and what not to do. We don't listen primarily to people. Paul says we do listen primarily to God. What will happen if we do this? What will happen and where will God take us? I want to land with God empowers the body to love to the end. God empowers the body to love to the end. When we were first talking about discipleship program priorities, this idea of we want to focus on a few things. One of the things we wanted to focus on was serving. And I remember somebody asking, well, where do we focus on love? And I was so excited to say, look, throughout Scripture, the picture of loving is serving. These words are synonyms. John wrote, this is how we know what love is. Jesus Christ laid down his life for us. And we ought to lay down our lives for each other. We ought to serve each other. This is how we love each other. Fair question is to say, hey, we just read chapter 12, and I don't see the word serve or love anywhere in chapter 12. You would be right. However, the application of chapter 12 is chapter 13. What is 1 Corinthians 13? That's the love chapter that everybody reads at weddings, right? Let me read it to you. This is the application of chapter 12. This is where he moves us when we listen to the Lord. That God empowers the body to love to the end. That if we'll trust our God who delights in us, and allow him to use us to serve and be served, we'll love like chapter 13. That people actually can, by God's grace and power, the miracle can happen that you and I can love like this. Chapter 13, verses 4 through 7. Imagine if this is what people say when they look at the chapel. Their love is patient. Their love is kind. People at the chapel, their love does not envy or boast. That those people over there, their love is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. That if we'll trust God and His plan, that we'll listen primarily to Him and be the body He's calling us to be, that we don't have to have sad stories like my friend who loved well for a period and then made devastating, unloving decisions that destroyed relationships that were most important to him. That the opposite happens. If we say, Lord, at all costs, use me in any way you want to use me. Lead me to serve wherever you would have me to serve and bring people in my life, have them serve and do whatever needs to be done. Lord, that I might be empowered to love to the end. All the way to chapter 15, where Paul's talking about resurrection day. That we would love well, not just in this moment, but all the way to the end. To the day when Christ returns and once and for all puts down fear and division in death and mourning forever. Would you please stand for the benediction? After the benediction, the service is over and you're welcome to go out into the foyer. By the time we get to the end of chapter 15, Paul has this to say to the church. And may it be our benediction today. 1 Corinthians 15:58. Therefore, my beloved brothers, God delights in us. Be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord, your labor is not in vain. Amen. And have a wonderful week.